This is Eye on Real Estate, your premier source for real estate information. From the heart of New York City and the tri-state area to the most active real estate hotspots across America. Keeping you plugged in to the latest real estate market trends, from mortgage news and legal developments to everything you need to know about buying or selling a property, benefited by the advice of the experts. Now, here's the host of Eye on Real Estate, the vice chair of Douglas Elliman, Dottie Herman.
We're back, and I have, again, because when I think of commercial real estate and I think of who writes and who I trust the most of all the information of all the people that I know who do commercial real estate to write on it, that's Lois Weiss. She's a writer for New York Post, Between the Bricks, many more, and she's an expert on commercial real estate. So I wanted to... We started our conversation, I think, last week, and I wanted to come back because everybody asked, and we didn't get to finish. But before I do that about the New York City commercial market and some of you who are looking to enter it, I want to ask Lois, how did you get started writing for commercial real estate? Like, how did that all begin?
Okay, it's a little bit crazy, and thanks, Dottie, for having me back again. I appreciate it. You're always a font of information, too, on home buying, which I appreciate. So I was really a rock and roll writer, and my husband was doing tax certiorari, which is basically challenging city tax assessments, and he was going out on his own, and I called up the editor of Real Estate Weekly, and I said, oh, you can do a byline story at the time, and except the assessments are going to come out January 15th, and can you extend a deadline for me because you don't publish for a couple of weeks? So we started chatting, and she asked me to cover the press conference on the release of the tax roll. So I said, sure, and I knew nothing about it, and I asked my husband and my father-in-law, and they gave me a few questions to ask, and I went to the press conference, and I wrote a story. And at the time, I think I was saying this last week to your listeners, that they were assessing the properties at 45% of the sale price, and it had killed real estate. Every one of the buildings on Broadway in the downtown were already owned at that point by the insurers, John Hancock, Mass Mutual. Each one of them owned these buildings because they had foreclosed already. Right. So after I handed in that article, the editor at the time was Maggie Rance. She said, hey, there's something going on with the co-ops. And this guy, Francis Greenberger, told the attorney general he can't keep these co-ops anymore because he had essentially taken the rent-stabilized buildings, co-opted them, and now he couldn't sell them, and he had to pay for all the taxes and the maintenance on them. So that turned into a three-part series, and then from there I just kept writing for Real Estate Weekly for about 10 years. And then I decided I wasn't getting paid as much as the porters and the doormen in the buildings. So I quit. And within a week, the people from the New York Post said, hey, we'd love you to come work for us, but we don't have a desk. And I said, that's great, because I don't want a desk. I work out of my house. So I started doing a column for them. And I was also, the whole time I was writing for Real Estate Weekly, I was also writing for Habitat on co-ops and condos, and writing about... for City Feet at the time, I was doing their weekly news blast, and I started meeting people in the industry and going to events, and I just kept going. So, I like it that you know, people say, oh, well, I don't want to work out. I work out of my house, but I don't want to go into the office. Well, yeah, I was in my house, but I went to events probably two or three times a week with groups of people. And people ask me all the time, oh, come in and I'll have coffee with you. Well, coffee for me is like 5 hours. You know, you get dressed, you know, I have to go in. It's way too much. So I do group events and building tours and things like that, press conferences. So that's how it all started, and I just kept going.
No, it's phenomenal, and I say that to so many people. I have a granddaughter who's getting ready to go to school, and she's like, but I don't know what I want to do. And I said, well, not everybody knows what they want to do, and a lot of it, you know, is after you get out of school, you get some kind of a job, and then you kind of gravitate to what you like. I wanted to be a teacher. How I ended up, real estate was the... wasn't even in my radar. Okay. Sure. However, I was dating the devil. I was dating who I ended up marrying, but I was dating a man that was a certiorari attorney.
And oh, really?
Yes. And I didn't even know what certiorari was at the time.
Yes.
And I'm like, certiorari. And then when he explained it to me, and I was like, oh, that sounds boring. This is all numbers, and you know, it's challenging assessments, but he's like, you know, you'd be great in real estate. Why don't you ever give it a... So I said, well, I don't know. But, you know, I figured, oh, I'll just take the test and see, and I'll just play it by ear. And that's really how it all began. So you never know where you end up.
No, listen, I wanted to be a veterinarian, and I had a microbiology teacher who said to me, forget it, you're much better at business and marketing and things like that. So I went from, you know, dairy cows and beef farming to buildings, bricks, and, you know, frankly, everything. You know, everybody I know went from job to job and just, you know, growing in that job. And that's how you kind of find your path.
Right. And, you know, get out there, go to organizations, go to things, and, you know, eventually you find your way. I happen to love real estate, but it was nothing that I've ever, like, said, oh, gee, that's what I want to do when I get, you know, that's what I want to do. I wanted to be what people my age then wanted to be. I still wanted to be a teacher or a social worker or something of that sort. So,
yeah.
But
it's funny because I have to say, you know, Bob Knackel, who's now out on his own, has a story about driving, I think, some kids, you know, his friends of his sons, and they started talking about how they want to be in real estate, and that seems to be something now that is actually a career path for people, and a lot of the universities like NYU and Fordham and Baruch all have... you know, training programs and college classes aimed at real estate for both undergrads and graduates. So, I think it's pretty terrific. I think Penn has a program too, and there's a few others, especially the people who have made money in real estate. A lot of them are founding these. You know, the Shack Institute over at NYU was founded by Kenny Shack, whose family owned retail properties in Soho, and he made a lot of money selling one, and he put it back into the school to teach other kids. So
it's really funny because when I started real estate, you know, it was not this glamorous thing. Okay.
Yeah.
And I don't have this. This is just my opinion, but I think that, you know, everyone knows about it. But a lot of these shows, you know, you see them on the shows, and they're like all gorgeous and they're good looking. And I'm listening to them negotiate $1 million over the phone. You know, like, oh yeah, like go make that offer. Just give the, I think maybe make it $1.5 million less, and they're on the phone. Party, making it you know what? I think in a way it's good because it really, you see people how successful they could be, And you really can be successful in real estate if you want to. If you want to work. Because many people have their licenses and really don't make money because they're really not working. But if you really want to work and you're willing to give it all, and I also think sometimes you have to be passionate about something, because if you're not passionate, I don't know how great you could be. But you really can make money, and you see it's young. You see all the young kids now are in real estate. Mm-hmm. A lot of, you know.
And you know, what they don't realize is the time that's spent not just being on the phone, but it's touring buildings and then meeting people, because you want to have clients. So a lot of the guys that do really well are out at events several times, a week, if not, you know, more. And they join clubs and they meet the people who have money to buy and sell. And that's how, you know, you get your clients. You have to run in a crowd that, does that. But I tell you, a lot of people find, you know, a group of friends in college and they go on to do wonderful things. And it's also about keeping in touch with people. I think that's so important. And at least today they have the social media to do it. So you can be in touch with hundreds of people, even though you don't see them on a regular basis. And that's another thing, you know, people like Jeff Sutton, he'll call property owners for years, once a week, once a month. I don't know how often he does it, but he just will schmooze with them, learn about their families, and maybe 10 years down the road, they decide they want to sell. And, you know, he'll buy the property from them. So it's all about relationship building and, you know, making people trust you and learning about things. I mean, you know, as a reporter, you know, people say to me, oh, write a book. And I'm like, I can't write a book because I'd be, you know, telling on all these people who said, don't tell. So, you know.
You have confidence. Definitely with a client, and if you ruin that, I mean, that's the end of your career, in my opinion. But I do think that, you know, as I said, I think it's a great profession if you like it, but it's a lot of work, and it's not only work, keep in touch with people, and it's a lot of timing. Sometimes, you know, you just don't hit the person at the right time, so you have to keep it up. And as you said, I think it's a little easier now with the internet to reach people. Mm-hmm. I remember handwriting letters, but it's still, you know, and then you see all the shows, everything's about real estate, you know, real estate, whether that, it's a surprising thing. But let me ask you, with commercial real estate, because people ask me that, if somebody, first of all, two questions. One, how's it doing in New York City? And two, if someone's considering buying, and when I say commercial real estate, it could be, I mean, there's all different types of commercial real estate. So let's talk about investment real estate.
Okay, so to buy a property now, I mean, first of all, you got to have, you know, some money, because if you need a loan, but you know, a lot of people I know started out by buying a warehouse somewhere and were able to rent it out without much effort. And certainly people who had warehouses, they were like, you know, it wasn't sexy, it wasn't fancy, and yet that became a very desirable asset because of all the purchasing we do online, and they need places to keep the stuff. It's called the last mile, where all the goods are brought to a place close to the city and then redistributed in the smaller trucks and vans and bicycles within the city, so that the big 18-wheelers don't have to run around on Park Avenue and have the guy hop out of his car and bring you your package. Instead, you have somebody on a bike doing it, or, you know, a UPS van. So that's one way. Some people have bought, it's funny because a lot of doctors, because they have some extra money, they'll get together and they'll buy an office. They may buy the office building that they're in and then rent it to, you know, the other people in the building. That happens an awful lot, especially with the small medical buildings. People will buy what they call a triple net leased property, where the person who is renting the property is also paying the taxes and the upkeep on and maintenance on the property. And that would be like you could net lease it to a retail store or a fast food place. So a lot of those come up for purchase quite a bit, it'll be a lease, and you hope that the Burger King or McDonald's, you know, pays on its on its lease and stays there for the 20 years or so. And then they may re-rent it to somebody or resell it. People buy strip malls and rent them out. A strip mall is, you don't see it in the New York City so much, but you do in the boroughs and in the suburbs, where it's a place usually like with parking in front, and there'll be, you know, a deli and a little restaurant, and maybe a karate place, or little small stores or a real estate and a hair salon. So there's a number of uses that come in and use the parking and leave. And they may have something that works at night when there's less need for the parking lot for the other tenants, a restaurant or a place that does, classes at night. So that's one way to do it. A lot of the lawyers and, people that deal in real estate and have clients end up investing, and they'll put some money into a deal, and that's another way to go. But you really have to be careful who you invest with. It's your money, and you're not going to have a great say on what happens to it. And there may be also capital calls where they need money to do a tenant improvement or something else. You may have to put more money back into the property. Right, Dottie? I mean, I'm sure you've hear about that.
You do. But I think that people, a lot of people ask, and sometimes if people give information and they mean well, but they're giving information based on their own experience or their financial, wherewithal. I do think that if you want to get into commercial real estate or anything like that, that what you said is great advice, that you should go to things. You'll find a lot of real estate agents, whether they be commercial or residential, they're glad to share some information. They're glad to share information. And it's not easy. But nothing in life is, I don't think it's easy, but you got to start somewhere, Okay, I think we're going to have a break, Lois. So I'm going to just put on hold for a second. And then I want you to just finish up and give us a summary of what you see and what your predictions are for the rest of 2024 going into a little of 2025. We'll be right back. I think we have a quick commercial break.
A Over the last 30 years, Newman Ferrara, a New York City law firm, has evolved into a national practice focused on real estate, commercial, litigation, civil rights, class actions, and other complex litigation, representing many of the city's largest property owners, managing agents, and thousands of tenants. Newman Ferrara handles some of the nation's most significant class actions and civil rights matters. Newman Ferrara at 1250 Broadway in New York City. Go online to NewmanFerrara.com. That's NewmanFerrara.com. Listen to the firm's name partner, Lucas Ferrara, every Saturday at 10 a.m. on Dottie Herman's longest-running real estate radio program, Eye on Real Estate on AM 970. A real estate lawyer for 35 years, Lucas is a professor at New York Law School and is also a published author with books on real estate and New York's landlord-tenant law. Tune in Saturdays at 10 a.m. to hear Lucas's unique perspective and advice on Eye on Real Estate. You know, the boys this summer are back at it, and Route 22 Toyota in Hillside, New Jersey means it's time for their Grand Slam event. Our friend Alex Kinsella is a big baseball fan. He's celebrating the season with the best offers of the year, like zero down leases on all your favorite Toyota models. 1.99% APR financing for up to 72 months. At Route 22 Toyota, they're offering unbelievable lease deals starting at just $79 a month on some of your favorite Toyota models. Call them today, 973-705-8905, and have Alex's team show you how easy it is to get into a new Toyota during their Grand Slam event. Again, that's 973-705-8905. You speak with someone from Route 22 Toyota about your favorite Toyota model. And remember, everybody drives thanks to their goal for 100% credit approval during their Grand Slam event from Route 22 Toyota in Hillside, New Jersey. Tell them Joe sent you.
Offers end April 30th, subject to primary lender approval. Leasing and financing on select new Toyota models through TFS. Not all buyers will qualify. Call or visit Route22Toyota.com for details.
A whole generation of kids knows little or nothing about our nation's darkest day, 9/11, the day our nation was attacked and 2,977 people were killed. Today, more than 80,000 people are suffering with 9/11 related illnesses. The Tunnel to Towers Foundation's 9/11 Institute helps educate kids in kindergarten through 12th grade about 9/11. The 9/11 Institute offers nonfiction, first-person accounts told through videos and the Discovering Heroes book series. The curriculum teaches about 9/11 while teaching kids skills. The Institute has a speakers bureau for classrooms, providing access to 9/11 first responders, survivors, and loved ones. A mobile exhibit, a tractor trailer that's an interactive museum with 9/11 artifacts. To never forget, we must educate future generations. Donate $11 a month to Tunnel to Towers at t2t.org. T, the number 2, and t.org.
Continuing with Eye on Real Estate, your premier source for real estate information. Here's the host of Eye on Real Estate, the vice chair of Douglas Elliman, Dottie Herman.
We're back. I say the slowest way to anybody, and anybody in real estate, especially commercial, knows Lois. Lois, before you go, would you just give us maybe a little summary of what you see going on in commercial real estate in the New York metropolitan area?
Sure. So the worst thing that's going on is that the legislature doesn't seem to recognize that owners of multifamily apartments need to do a lot of work when a tenant leaves and put in a lot of money, and they need to get a return on that money. So the legislature is, you know, was working on something last night that everybody's very upset about, and it doesn't provide enough funds to rehabilitate the apartments that have been kept off the market because the 2019 law changed that so that people can't make enough money to maintain them. So that's, you know, an issue, and it's why there's been a lot of sales of multifamily buildings and a lot of foreclosures are starting to happen because people don't have the money to pay the mortgages, and everything's been devalued. The commercial buildings, The ones that are doing really well are the most up-to-date, modern, amenitized, and wonderfully located. And then the ones that are older, you can actually get a great deal. You might be able to get an office in the high 30s and the high 40s in the area, both downtown and below 42nd Street. You can find some great deals if you need an office. And retail is doing quite well. The luxury retailers are buying their buildings, and people still want to invest in New York. And by the way, if somebody wants to get into it, James Nelson and Rachel Hartman have a book, The Insider's Guide to Real Estate Investing. And James also has a newsletter you can sign up for at jamesnelson.com. And that's a great way to learn the ins and outs of getting into real estate. One of the things I also see people doing is buying a 1-3 family home and living in it, and then renting out the other two apartments, because there are no rent there's no rent cap on those homes. But eviction is a big issue, and it's our New York system right now, and it could take years to evict somebody if they decide not to pay anymore.
I know. That's because I could talk 2 hours. I was reading that, then I was reading something that they only want to raise like 3% or something like that if somebody renews. And just a whole bunch of stuff. But I think that you're right, Lois. You really, I'd love to have you on again, always. I love you on, but really, you've been great. And I thank you for sharing your time, because I really appreciate it. And I will see you real soon. I owe you a dinner, so one night we'll go out and have dinner.
Okay. All right, great, Dottie. Thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
Lois is just a sensation. She's great and so knowledgeable. And now with us, he's been on the show plenty, so you know him, our financial guy, our financial expert, mortgages, Amit Drew.
Dottie, good morning. How are you? So glad to be back. Great to hear you.
Oh, great to hear you. I mean, we were on with in the beginning of the show with an attorney who was talking about all cash deals. And I said, well, that's great, but not everybody has all cash. And even if you do, there's a decision you want to make, whether you want to tie up all that cash that you have. That's kind of personal, but we were talking about how if you are not an all cash buyer, which most people don't have the cash to buy, unless they've been given the money or they have a couple of houses already. But when someone starts, we were saying to compete with an all cash deal, wouldn't you suggest that they have a go to a mortgage company, go to yourself, and get a pre-approval or pre-commitment?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think now in this market, you really have to be prepared, right? Because you are going up against all cash buyers if you're not all cash yourself, right? So be prepared. I would say, meet with your lender, provide all the information that they ask for. They're not asking for all this information to be nosy or to be annoying, right? They need to have a complete picture of you as a borrower to make sure that there's no issues when you do go to contract, right? And you're trying to close on the house. So I would say be as thorough as possible, because you're just, if you're not, you're putting yourself in a position where, sort of like that false hope, like, I think I'm good, but I'm not good because, hey, they uncovered some things along the way. So, it's sort of like, when you're speaking to your doctor, right, you want to tell them everything. It's kind of the same way with your banker when it comes to a mortgage.
And, wouldn't you suggest, though, that, like, as I said, when somebody gets, that means that they are approved for X amount of money. provided that the appraisal of the
correct. Exactly. It's always subject to the appraisal, right, Dottie? And look, we would take them so far as, you know, a pre-approval, and if they needed something even beyond that, we would arrange for that loan to get reviewed by an underwriter, so we know that there are no hiccups down the road, right? So, look, certainty is something that everyone needs nowadays, especially in a real estate transaction. Because just even getting your offer accepted, right, Dottie, like that's a challenge in and of itself in this extremely competitive market. So now more than ever, I tell everybody, don't take chances. Like, know what you're getting yourself into in terms of, you know, how much money you need to work with to buy the home, including closing costs and what your monthly payments are going to be. And look, at the end of the day, you shouldn't forsake everything just to buy a home, right? If you're going to put yourself in a very difficult situation, just trying to live. So we want to make sure that you're kind of taking all that into consideration before you make an offer.
You don't want to be cash poor because something always goes wrong with a house. I don't care if it's brand new. But in preparation for that, okay, so if you know that you're thinking of buying a home in the near future, there are things that you should do ahead of time, in my opinion, like not, you know, and maybe when you meet the loan officer, like you would say to someone, well, maybe if you have this car payment on, then you might want to pay the car off and have, you know, less obligation. Because when a bank looks at you, they're going to look at your debt, how much debt you're carrying. So some of the things that I think, and maybe you could elaborate on that, that people should do or maybe not do, is when you're thinking of buying a home, you shouldn't take on another big debt.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, a great question. What we call the debt-to-income ratio, right? So when you're buying a home, you know, your income is your income, right? Like, you're not going to magically, like, make more money overnight, right? You kind of have either you're self-employed or you're employed, and you have a pretty good idea of what your income is. But what most people don't consider is how much debt they're carrying, right? And I tell everybody, there's expensive debt, right? And there's debt that hurts your credit score. And there's debt that, you know, you have no choice, but, you know, it is what it is, right? And when we look at that, we'll look at possibilities to improve your debt-to-income ratio. And ideally, you know, you don't want to spend more than, say, 40 to 45% of all of your income on debt, including the mortgage, right?
Okay.
I think that's a pretty high threshold, too, on top of it, right? I mean, most people would not want to push their limits that high, but that's kind of what the banks will approve. So if we take a look at, you know, car payments, student loans, credit cards, personal loans, right? All these things that you have every month as an expense. And, you know, we kind of look and say, well, you know, where's the best bang for your buck to reduce your debt, improve your credit score, without having to lay out a lot of money to do that, right? So we might kind of go through the credit report, you know, highlight a few things, say, hey, pay this off, and this off, and that will give you, you know, some more room in your debt-to-income ratio, and most likely at the same time help your credit score go higher, which at the end of the day is a big positive as well, right, in terms of the interest rate that you pay. So there is, you know, your loan officer should take the time to do that and shouldn't just say, well, you know, here's what the rate you'd get, right, if you applied today. A really good loan officer will take the time, because if you're not ready to pull the trigger today and you have some time to work through this, they would kind of come up with a plan, strategy to help put you in the best position possible for that moment in time.
Yeah, Tom, one of the things that I was telling someone the other day, okay, we have a quick break, but before the break, I just wanted to do this, we'll do it after the break. When banks pose mortgage rates, the rates that they're posting are for people's credit pretty clean. So that's why after the break, I want to talk about what are the things you should do before, you know, you go for the mortgage, because that's showing people who have great credit. what some of the things that you can do to improve your credit or improve some of the obligations you have.
Mike Lindell and MyPillow don't have the support of box stores or shopping channels the way they used to. It's part of this cancel culture, so they want to pass the savings directly on to you. They are having a $25 extravaganza. When Mike started MyPillow, it was just a problem solution, one product company. Since then, with the help of his dedicated employees, they now have hundreds of products. To get the word out, they're having a $25 extravaganza. Two-pack multi-use MyPillows, just $25. My pillow sandals, $25. The six-pack towel set, $25. The four-pack dish towels, you guessed it, $25. For the first time ever, premium My Pillows with all new Giza fabric, any size and any loft level, just $25. This amazing offer will not last long, so order now. Go to MyPillow.com or call 800-651-0798. Use the promo code Joe P.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is Joan Herman, host of Change Your Attitude, Change Your Life's Conversations with Joan. Conversations with Joan focuses on topics that are important to your life. Every Sunday night, some of the world's most inspirational and influential people join me to discuss health and wellness, professional development, and personal well-being. They share their insights, tips, and strategies so you can thrive and live your best life now. Take time for yourself. Tune into Conversations with Joan every Sunday night at 10 p.m. right here on AM 970 The Answer. If you miss a show, be sure to visit our website so you can listen on demand. And while you're there, read our digital magazine and take part in our book club. Visit CYACYL.com. That's CYACYL.com.
Brandon Tatum, weeknights at 8 on AM 970 The Answer.
Continuing with Eye on Real Estate, your premier source for real estate information. Here's the host of Eye on Real Estate, the vice chair of Douglas Elliman, Dottie Herman.
With Dottie Herman, we're talking with Thomas Drew about mortgages and what to look for. And I think I was saying in the beginning of our conversation, Thomas, that what banks post as their interest rate, and what are the interest rates now?
Yeah, I'd say around 7%, for 30-year fixed conforming as of Friday. So not the highest we've seen, but certainly not the lowest. But those are generally like what they post as their best rate as of Friday.
And I was listening to them say that they thought they would get inflation down. I mean, they were waiting to get inflation down to about 2%, and it's not there yet. So that I was reading that they don't look like there's going to be some, you know, lower mortgage rates for a while yet. I mean, they're probably not going to lower the interest rates for a bit. But as I said, they're posting the best interest rate. You know, the interest rates they're posting are their best interest rates, and they're for people who have good credit. So if you don't have as good a credit, isn't your interest rate, even if they give you a mortgage, wouldn't you pay a higher interest rate?
Oh, absolutely. So they're always going to put their best foot forward on the internet, right, to show the best rate possible. And typically that's a tier one credit. You know, if you go a score out of an 850, 760 is sort of tier one credit, right, and higher. And typically that's either 20 or 25% down is what they're quoting on the internet, right? So if you're not meeting that criteria, well, you should expect to pay a higher rate than what's posted. And in some cases, if your credit is significantly below that, the rate, unfortunately, would be much higher. And that's, that, like I said, that's one of the reasons why we want to sit down with somebody months, you know, even a year before they're considering, so we can kind of lay out the best path possible to help get them there, right? Where they'll have the highest credit score, maybe a lower DTI, and potentially the best rate possible. You know, in some cases it is what it is, but it's better to plan than to just be surprised, right, when you go to sign the contract to buy a home.
That's what I think a lot of people don't know or don't understand. So when they're looking, that's why you should definitely use a mortgage broker, somebody who can help you. And you want to do this in advance. You do not want to wait till you found the house you like, you want to find the house you want to buy. You want to do this in advance, because there's things that a mortgage broker can tell you that if you do this, it'll help you get a better interest rate, you know, mortgage rate. So some of the things that you advise people on are, you know, would you tell them maybe, you know, maybe pay some car payment off, or if they can pay some bills off. Definitely, if you don't have to change jobs, I don't think the banks like when you change jobs all the time. Now, what about a person that has a business, all right? And a lot of times, maybe they're not showing that amount of money their business makes.
Yes.
How does an entrepreneur have their own business, and, you know, it's not like a steady, you know, it's not like a salary that you know the person's salary every week. What type of mortgages, or how should they go about things?
For a self-employed borrower?
Yeah.
Look, I think it's important that the bank or the lender that they're dealing with reviews at least 2 years worth of tax returns, right? Most people are just filing their returns for 2023 right now, right?
Right.
And look, in some cases, accountants are doing their job. They're trying to minimize the taxes that self-employed individuals pay, right, taking advantage. But that always doesn't benefit you when it comes to qualifying for a mortgage. So, look, in some cases, you may have, say, your husband and wife, one of them self-employed, one of them is employed, right? So we try to look at both incomes, potentially even adding a co-applicant or a co-signer onto the loan if their income isn't enough on paper to qualify. So we try to look at all these different ways to help people get into homes. But at the end of the day, what banks use is really your taxable income, right? That's kind of what we're looking at to see, what you qualify for, especially on a self-employed borrower. So if you have a great accountant who's writing up most of your income, that's another challenge that we'll have to contend with.
Right. So if you do this in advance, you work with a broker, and before you find something, it's your best shot of getting the best mortgage rate you can get, because there's things sometimes that you can do ahead of time that will help you ready to buy the home have a better rate. And of course, it's not spending a whole lot of, making big investments, buying a new car or anything of that nature, making sure that, you know, the credit that you have, having, your credit gone over so that you know if there's any mistake. Sometimes it could just be a mistake.
Absolutely. If you've had credit open for a long time, say certain cards, do not close them, right? Don't take any drastic actions, because that also can impact the credit score.
Yeah, I never understood that. I always, I know that they tell you not to get rid of a credit card. Why?
Because one of the parts of the model of the FICO, the Fair Isaac and Company, right? The FICO score, which is your credit score, is the length of open credit that you have. It's one of those inputs that creates the score. So if you have a card that you've had open for a long time, so I know some people have credit cards forever.
Right.
That's really helping you generate a higher score than, say, somebody who has just a couple of years worth of credit. So the last thing you want to do is close that particular account. It's just going to, it potentially could knock off 50 to 100 points off your score, because now you've shut down a longstanding trade line that you have on your credit report. And the other thing is, too, like, just to have credit and not utilize it isn't good either, right? So I tell people, look, you want to have a credit card or a couple, use it responsibly, like use them every month, pay them off every month. As a matter of fact, you could pay, and I'm guilty of this, as soon as I charge something, I literally go into the account and just pay it so that I'll wait for a monthly statement to hit. But I'm using it, right? There's activity on the report, there's activity on the card, and it helps drive up your credit score, right, without really driving, pushing your debt-to-income ratio higher. So these are all little tips and tricks that I would, if I was sitting down with somebody, I'd say, hey, here's how we get from, you know, A to Z, and this is what I would do. Data my credit score by doing these things, right? And I try to be as helpful as possible with someone, because at the end of the day, you really want their home purchase to be an exciting time, not a stressful time, not, you know, whether or not they're worried, whether or not they're actually going to get the mortgage. So try to be as certain as possible with the process with them.
Now, Thomas, I know that there's no one size fits all when it's buying a home or getting a mortgage. But when you're talking with somebody and someone's debating on, okay, talking to you and saying, well, maybe I should get an adjustable. What's an average differential between a 30-year fixed mortgage, where meaning that your payments are going to be the same, they don't change, or an adjustable mortgage? Maybe you could explain the difference to our audience.
Sure. It all has to do with, in my opinion, how long that somebody plans on being in the home. So the difference today, say between a 7-year adjustable and a 30-year fixed, is somewhere between 0.5% and 0.75% in the interest rate. So depending on how much you're going to borrow, that could make a sizable difference in that monthly payment, right? And what we see a lot of times, say in New York City, you know, maybe they're buying a co-op or a condo, and their plan is not to be there more than 5 or 7 years. So a lot of people in Manhattan will finance with an adjustable rate mortgage. So as you move like north, west, you know, east of Manhattan, you'll see the likelihood that somebody takes an ARM kind of drops, right? They're more interested in a fixed rate because they, you know, in their minds, I plan on being in this house for much longer. And they'll finance more accordingly. But overall, I would say there are, say, compared to when rates were 3% and now they're, say, 7, there are definitely more people taking adjustable rate mortgages today than there were just, say, 2 or 3 years ago.
Well, because at 3%, I mean, that was an unheard mortgage. That was a rate that was like unheard of for at least most of my lifetime. And if you could lock in at 3%, why would you take the adjustable if you didn't have to, where you know that that's not going to get much lower? But like when I bought my first house, I think the interest rates were probably like 13 or 14%. So therefore, it didn't stop me from buying a house because you got to start somewhere. But I definitely took a 5-year ARM, 5-year adjustable, because I was assuming that that's a very high interest rate and that they would eventually come down and then I would eventually refinance, and which I did. And I was just very lucky that every time my adjustable rate adjusted, the mortgage rate was a little bit lower. So I really benefited by doing that. But for those people who need, you know, a little bit less of a payment or think the rates are high now, I think they're kind of, I mean, it's just my opinion, I think they're kind of average. I don't know if I think they're really high. I don't think they're low, but I've seen them much higher. What would you say? Do you see them coming down to like 5 is the number that you think is the big number?
Well, if it's going to get there, it's going to take a little bit longer
And I think also Thomas, you have to come back because it's really important to know.
The preceding hour of programming paid for by DTHY Realty Incorporated.